Hello and welcome to Power Reflections, a proud member of the Doof Network, where we reflect on Wildbo's most wordy work as it releases. I'm Ruben Morehouse.
And I'm Elliot Diebold.
And we're coming at you live in the Discord. No, we're not, because I've been traveling, but funnily enough, that's why I'm here, because I'm at Elliot's house right now. It's a nice place, Elliot.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm enjoying it so far. So Ruben's come to check out my new digs.
Yeah.
And so luckily that means I don't have to record this one alone. We get to do it together, which I'm very excited about.
Yeah, me too. So as usual, you know, we're here to talk about the work of Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Am I right? 100 Years of Solitude.
Yeah.
Research that joke. And here we go. I guess we should start talking about the chapter.
Oh, sorry, hold on. Let's just take a break.
We'll cut this. Yeah, yeah.
Sorry about that. Back now. So first up this week is Left in the Dust 16.4. Extra material, excerpts from A 100 Years Lost, the book about Hazel's life. This was like a nice Christmas present to us from Wildbo, rather than doing like what would have been a pretty important chapter. He took some time in the holidays to give us this instead, which is like so nice, but also, you know, especially based on his comment at the bottom of it, I can't believe that ended up being easier, because this is a lot in a very different way and maybe more self-contained. So there's like less of that wider weight, but there's so much to this. Something that we know is that Wildbo really likes to include plot in any sort of textbook excerpts. He doesn't just want to write textbooks. He likes to include some sort of characterization or plot or something. And so this 100 Years Lost is just the perfect book for him to do, because it's half like biography, half textbook. And then you've also got the layer of commentary on top, which I love how even our annotator, I've forgotten his name, but Mr. Ray, has a personality in this that sort of comes through. It's got that classic sort of feel that a lot of the practitioner textbooks do from Ray's end, where it's a bit masturbatory. He loves to mention everything he and his family have had to do with this. But that, you know, that's really clever from a writing perspective, because that's allowing him to write a bunch of stuff that, you know, probably doesn't need to be in here, but is part of the character. So it lets him do more characterization. It's a great like positive feedback loop. And that this guy loves to write everything about him and his family. And in fact, that's actually what we open with. It starts with a foreword from Mr. Ray, who gives us, just mostly the background on Hazel and her work. And then, as I said, a lot of himself and his family are in there too. And I mean, we've already talked about this, I suppose, but the premise of Hazel is so cool. Like, she's this woman who was just so ahead of her time that, like 50-ish years after she's disappeared, the rest of the community is still drastically playing catch up. Like, some of them have glimpsed these constructions, and that's as close as anyone else has gotten that they know of. I really struggled to find like a good real world comparison to this, and I think the best I can do is like, if you believe all of the nonsense that Nikola Tesla fans make up about like what he was, you know, gonna do, and like all the lasers and shit, like that's almost what it feels like. Like, Nikola Tesla was this guy who was, for various reasons, not given the credit he was due. And if you believe all that crazy stuff, it's like he was like 100 years ahead, and you know, we're all just only catching up now. And that's sort of what Hazel feels like in a way. Paris is this guy's name. And I love how we established that Paris is more progressive than his father and grandfather. Like, you get this sense that time is progressing and the world's getting better, but you know, also he's not perfect himself. He softens their words, but kind of takes the time to be like, my grandfather did have a go at her here. And you know, it is still like what, the fourth guy in a row writing about Hazel, presumably all white guys. So you know, again, just kind of missing the point with Hazel stuff. So, then after the forward, we get into a diary entry from year zero of Hazel's diary. And I guess this is probably the point where I do just need to say the kind of obligatory, this episode, especially because it's a solo one, is really not going to do justice to this chapter. I think probably the most interesting thing that Wildbo did here from my perspective is like create this super interesting puzzle box. Like anyone who's been on the various Wildbo discords or subreddits this week will know how much fun everyone's had trying to unwrap just the plethora of mysteries Wildbo dropped into this chapter. I'm going to try and touch on some of that, but you know, it obviously doesn't make great audio. Again, especially since I'm alone, so I'll call out what I can, but like, I'm not going to do justice, I guess, just how much every other segment of this chapter is just crammed full of little, yeah, pieces of this puzzle that it's inviting you to try and put together, and it's raising questions and making you think about what the paths are, what Hazel's up to, like all this great stuff. It's such a fun concept. But yeah, sorry, getting back to year zero, Hazel's entry. This is basically her origin story. We find out about her piece of shit husband who beats her and killed her daughter. And she eventually runs away from him and manages to sort of push herself into the paths. It's a bit of a mystery exactly how she does that. But yeah, she makes it through the wolf or something similar to the wolf, and her husband makes it through and kind of continues this chase dynamic for a very long time. And I think what's really fun in this segment is it establishes how I almost wouldn't describe Hazel as lost so much as let down or left behind. Like, what the beat that really gets hit in this segment is her husband killed her daughter and beats her, and yet, like, the church has sided with him. Her coven has left her and sided with him. You know, is not talking to her out of fear. The police are on his side and he has them over for dinner. Like, he's just clearly this rat piece of shit, and everyone else has taken his side over her. So it's not so much that she got lost as though she slipped through the cracks or you know, was left behind. And it's sort of really setting up just how against, it was her against the world. And I guess, you know, spoilers, she's going to kind of end up winning. So yeah, after that, we skip a year ahead, and Hazel has basically kind of made a home for herself in the keyways, which is this really fun path where everything's a key. She has to use a key to unlock the ability to breathe each morning. It's super fun, but she eventually has to run away when the wolf shows up. And this is where she discovers this interesting paradox where you can push someone onto a path before you, and then they cop the problems that the path puts in front of you, and you don't. This is a paradox because the finders, well, they call it a paradox just because they haven't figured out how the fuck it works. Which is so fun because again, it's another example of how far behind the finders are, from Hazel. And it's just another example of a little mystery, a little puzzle that this chapter throws at you. So yeah, then we skip ahead to year 39. Hazel is just continuing to gun it. I mean, honestly, we've seen the paths. It's fucking bonkers that she's just lived here for 39 years. Like, that's wild. Anyway, Hazel just, yeah, encounters this new path, you know, solves it, no wuckers, and then runs into the Page of Suns, who's this, you know, kind of aspect of the paths that shows up and seems to be some sort of marker for new beginnings, or, you know, historical moments. And obviously we'll get to how this is used later, but I just love this concept of, like, in this universe, adding this personified marker of historic or important events. It's such a great idea to sort of say, hey, if the Page of Suns shows up, shit's real. And it's again, another hype thing for Hazel because she's going to just be hanging out with him casually later. But before then, we skip to year 60. And this is when Hazel finally makes it to Baby's first path, Forest Ribbon Trail. I guess at this point, this is one of the segments where Hazel has just collected a menagerie of wacky sidekicks. I can't even remember specifically which ones are from this segment because she's got different ones in each one. And I guess I just wanted to call that out because it helps lend the vibes that Hazel's story has to being like the super epic version of like Wizard of Oz or Alice in Wonderland. Like, I think both of those two stories have been specifically called out as being tales of the paths in the other verse. And there's like a distinct similarity to Hazel's journey and the journeys of Alice and, fuck, I've forgotten the name of the woman in The Wizard of Oz, but you know, it's similar to those two journeys, but Hazel's is definitely like the next level up, and you sort of really feel that with those similarities, but also the differences. Hazel's is a much more permanent. She you know, goes back to reality once and doesn't really seem to stick. It makes you think of, like, in year 39, the segment we just covered, the Page of Suns offered her a way home and she rejects it, whereas, you know, for the majority of Wizard of Oz, the whole point is to get home. And I'm not too familiar with Alice in Wonderland, but I think she eventually wants to go home in that. Obviously, we learn a lot about the Forest Ribbon Trail here too, in how it's kind of like broken or incomplete, like the version we're familiar with. So there's meant to be this sort of larger three-act structure. Although there was already kind of a three-act structure to the Forest Ribbon Trail, so maybe this is more like there's meant to be a sequel and then a third trilogy entry, I don't know. But basically, by the end, you eventually come to have sympathy for the wolf, and it's implied that you would want him to devour you, but it's not actually said that that's what would happen. So I almost feel like that, you know, this is, again, one of the puzzles that we get set up in this chapter, and it makes me feel like there's meant to be this more complete tale to the Forest Ribbon Trail where you come to understand your adversary, like the wolf is your opponent, your adversary. And then maybe the proper ending to this three-act Forest Ribbon Trail is to start to make peace with them or find a way forward together or something, like, I don't know, to kind of overcome your adversary in a less confrontational way. And presumably what's happened is the finders who first found the path kind of figured out the ending with the wolf and then just immediately like started sacrificing the child, their boon companion, instead and like made that a different way to complete it and kind of broke the path by establishing a different precedent. Because I think we've seen the early paths are quite malleable based on how the finders establish the patterns. So I just love this idea. Like, this just summarizes the practitioner and the finder community as like, the paths presented this big three-act structure of, oh, you know, you'll fight your enemy and then you'll come to understand them. And then, you know, maybe in the third act, there was going to be some sort of better resolution. And the practitioners instead were like, no, we're just going to sacrifice children to it and bail after the confrontation and not even fight it. That just feels right to me for who practitioners are. And I guess speaking of the child, I'm obviously referring to the boon companions as the child now. This is something else this chapter introduces, which is there are these like pillars or architects, or I would call them archetypes of the paths, because they're reminiscent of Jungian archetypes, I think. Like the wolf is the adversary, as I've already talked about. And then we introduce to the child, who seems to be, you know, some concept of childhood innocence or joy or something. And of course, like, again, this is just setting up that the finders, or the average finder, is beginning their career by taking the child aspect of the paths and sacrificing it to their adversary, which really just sets a tone for how they're going to interact with the paths. They're taking, yeah, like the Forest Ribbon Trail has been established as, you know, the first path you take to become a finder. And, you know, that is you sacrificing your childhood to your adversary. good job, finders. And it makes like Avery super interesting because she's someone who did this, but she not only kept her aspect of the child, she made it her familiar. Like, this is no doubt an aspect of why she was so readily accepted by other inhabitants of the paths, because it's a childlike and like whimsical space as a whole. And she's one of these few finders who not only kept this innocent childlike part of herself around, but she's like bonded herself to it. Like, it's almost this, if you view Snowdrop as an avatar of the child, it's almost Avery saying that she's never going to completely grow up into, you know, like that sort of serious adult practitioner, which, you know, feels very Avery to me. But yeah, so then we jump ahead to, I think it's year 93, and Hazel's basically collected all of these, you know, archetypes, pillars of the paths. It really adds, again, to that sense that she's this epic protagonist. She's also got one here who she just calls the Finder, that is like a copy of her that mysteriously disappears later. I'm not sure what's up with that. I expected her to use that one when she's building her five pillars with Pisces in a bit as the first pillar, but whatever. But yeah, you know, she's surrounded by the Queen of Ents, the Page of Suns, you know, Jackie Boy. Like, she's got the whole collection here. It has this really epic feel as she approaches this construction she's been avoiding. And she gets into the construction, goes through this ritual, and acquires her new mate Pisces. and the pair travel together for 5 years. Then there's some sort of kerfuffle on Pisces' end, and it causes him and seemingly the rest of his kind to get wiped out. And this is very much the section that's very, like, you know, tinfoil bait, basically. Rather than go over my own thoughts too much, I wanted to really pull from the community for this. So in the show notes, there's going to be a link to a document put together by, of course, Snowdrop's Tiny Fan, where she's been gathering all of the major theories that she's seen. And if you've got one and it's not in there, I think that doc can be edited, or you can add comments to submit your own. So please do, because this is very fun. Some of the top ones that are in that doc at the moment, there's one from Shin7, who basically theorizes that Pisces is a proper architect of the paths, who was sort of created by Hazel to essentially get replaced. So it's sort of this complicated theory a bit, where Pisces and his mates are all the architects, but Pisces is sort of a temporary architect who was constructed to train Hazel to replace him. There's a great theory from Greg, that Pisces is the part of herself she left behind when she entered the paths. So when Hazel pushed some of her being into the water, into the reflection, she kind of, her spirit entered the paths and her body entered a different part. And this is them kind of meeting in this midpoint at the middle. It's a very fun idea. Blizzard Kraken has a great theory about how Pisces represents the concept of home. And then the White Duke has a great one about how they're no one from nowhere. Again, I'm not really doing these theories justice either, but especially while I'm by myself, it just feels weird to go through them in detail. So check out the doc in the link below. There's also obviously like a bunch of other more general theories about, after my first read, I thought Pisces might be some sort of alien or, you know, mer creature or something. Just because of all the fish imagery and the vibe of first contact, there's like a lot here. And Snowdrop's Tiny Fan's doc also has like a diagram of how all the pillars are laid out in the room, which makes it a lot easier to do your own tinfoil. So it's definitely worth checking out if you want to vet your own before sending it in. But yeah, obviously, so, you know, Pisces gets deaded, and we jump to the afterword of this book. So we're back to Paris Ray's notes, and he begins to ponder who could be the next to so fundamentally change the concept of finding and practice. And then the text cuts off to show us Miss, who sees the page of Suns as she makes the decision to be the founder of Lost Kennet. And this is such a great, like, for a chapter that was mostly stepping away from the story, so Wildbo wasn't putting pressure on, this is a great tease at the end to really hit back hard, because we've just established the Page of Suns is somebody who will show up when shit is real, and you're about to do something historic and new. And then Miss sees him for presumably the first time as he shows up here, and that's just so great, because Miss has been doing so much this story. She's arguably one of the biggest architects of you know, what Kennet has been. But she was very much doing things her very losty way. It obviously didn't work. Whereas this is like her listening to the other people a lot more now. This is a more of a team effort, and she's making some sacrifices on her end. And it's so weirdly validating that the Page of Suns has shown up and just is saying to her and to us, yeah, this is a big deal. Yeah, it's so hype. So it gets you so excited for, yeah, our Lost Kennet. And I suppose with that, we can get into it more, because we're about to hit Left in the Dust 16.5. We got Verona. And yeah, it's you know, time to go back to the normal chapters, time to head back to the negotiations with the culprits, as we, you know, we work up to where we just were with Miss. So to start off with, the culprits lay down their terms for, you know, peace with the Kenneteers. Edith needs to be on the council again. They need any inclusion in protective measures that are set up. And finally, my favorite one, the Kenneteers need to make an oath to do no harm to them and help them if they're attacked. And I love this last one so much, because this is exactly what Lucy got the Kennet others to swear to them in the Awakening Ritual in 1.2. And, like, so this oath here is such a classic culprit move, because there's a world, there's a read where this is a fair request, where you're saying, hey, if we're going to have a truce, You need to not attack us. You need to help defend us. Like, let's actually be on the same team. Like, there's a world where that's a fair agreement. We saw it with the Canadothers and the Canadeteers in 1.2. But this is the culprit. So it's this twisted, bastardized version of that where it's like, no, you made this fucking mess and now you're trying to make it worse, but you want us to protect you from the people who will hurt you when you try to make it worse. It's such bullshit. And I mean, yeah, I just love it. That sort of hypocrisy is just rampant in all this. I love seeing our culprits in actions because they're so close to making sense, but they just miss it with this layer of hypocrisy and bullshit and lack of accountability for their own actions. And that, it just makes them such enjoyable villains because they're so close to our goodies and yet so far. And so, of course, it is Lucy who points out that, you know, they are offering to fix what they broke, as I just said, which is very true and is a very Lucy point to make. And there's also this great moment where, like, Marissica kind of gets pissy with them because she accuses, like, Verona and Lucy of acting like stubborn children. And they do kind of lean into that a bit and they are just, like, you know, unrelenting in how sort of childish and stubborn they are. And Marcy's giving them shit for this, and I just love that because she's the one who taught them to do that against Alexander in Arc 3. Like, you know, you reap what you sow, dipshit. These three, or, you know, these two here today know how to do shit like this because you taught them that, so suck eggs. Great. Another great example of the culprits not being ready to deal with the consequences to their actions. The talks start to get a bit more personal and a bit sidetracked, and the highlight of this is absolutely when Verona finally asks Liz the question we've all been wondering. She's like, what the fuck is she doing? What does she get out of this? What does she want? And her answer is vague and evasive, but the only thing we really get out of it is that she genuinely seems to believe in Chucky's vision, and she's just supporting him because she thinks he has the best solution. And specifically, she actually turns to Miss at this point and mentions that she thinks, like, Chucky will succeed and Miss wasn't going to. And then even has the audacity to say, see, look, you did fail, which is such a bullshit argument. Like, again, because, Liz, you're the reason it failed. Like, it's just, I'm probably going to have to just stop calling out the blatant hypocrisy and arguments made by the culprits from here on out, because it's just everything they make is, like, a good point until you stop to think about it for half a second. Then you're like, no, wait, actually, that's your fault that it's like that. It just makes this conversation so delightfully frustrating. That said, like, the extra info we do really get out of Liz here is that she has this real disdain for innocence. Like, her disdain for the status quo really extends to hatred for innocence. And, like, obviously, you know, Liz is a hypocritical, dumb piece of shit, but I get this. Like, we talked about this with Rook, actually. I think it was in a conversation with Lucy where Rook sort of said she doesn't think she hates innocence, but she gave the vibe that she's disappointed in them and the fact that they exist. And Liz is very much coming from more of a place that I might have expected someone like Rook to be in when we didn't know her as well. Because, like, yeah, it's not wrong to say that innocence is, you know, a lot of the time problematic. And so I hope this is, like, an avenue we continue to explore, because I love this as a motivation from Liz. Like, she, I think her hatred of innocence, especially based on where she grew up, like, you know, she was built out of a bunch of really fucking shitty innocence. And then her next exposure was the Aware, like the Witch Hunters, who are this kind of broken innocence. So I think it's kind of fair for her to have come out of that experience with, like, this irrational hatred of innocence and the concept of innocence. And so I'm just, yeah, really excited to sort of, I guess, see that explored more as we hopefully see more of Liz. But yeah, getting back to the talks, Marissica tries to bail, but Guillemet finally fucking does a thing. He finally steps up. I guess he finally has the upper hand now that she's so tired. And she is forced to answer Verona's question about, you know, basically what she did to Gilkey. And then she also spills a bunch of bullshit about, like, you know, how life is unfair and get you to do it and, you know, bunch of right-wing nonsense. But, like, the highlight here for me is just finally seeing Guillemet step up, finally seeing him slam it down like this. You really get this kind of sense of why the other fairy hate Winter so much, because Guillemet is so inflexible now. she can't change his mind. She tries to talk to him, but it's just this whole thing with Winter is he sets himself on a path and he will go through it with it for better or for worse. So from a fairy, like there's sort of no contingencies around being able to change that path. If a Winter fairy is on it, they're on it. And like that must be such a pain in the ass because so many of their plans boil down to setting up all these dominoes so that you don't do something or you do something at a critical moment and they can't change Winter Fairy. And then on top of that, the Winter Fairy is still fairy, so they're clever enough to anticipate all this bullshit. So they're just this worst nightmare for all the other fairy in a way because you can't negotiate with them, you can't reason with them, you can't trick them, which is like their main, you know, MO. But also they're clever enough to keep up with you. Like, so yeah, I can't wait to see more of Guillaume and the rest of the Winter Court in action. The Wild Hunt of Winter gets another mention here. Again, we get the update that, you know, they are doing a favor for Estrella and still hunting her. But more importantly, you know, Guillaume could get involved with that for better or for worse. Mariska walks away. She's a reverse Dumbo now. She can't fly. So with her, you know, pissed off to, you know, go avoid the primeval, Talk turns back to the negotiations somewhat. A truce is reached, and I use the word truce specifically because, as Lucy continuously points out, this is not an agreement for protections. It is a temporary truce, but it is reached. Edith is allowed back on the council, and Matthew basically immediately says he will be skipping the council for a while. Good call, bud. But yeah, the girls also won't go after the culprits for 6 months. And there's going to be some negotiations further down the track. A bunch of others are going to be allowed to move in that Liss wants, and they're, you know, violent shit ones. So that's going to be fun. But then in exchange, Verona is going to get the house on Half Street to do a domain ritual. Fuck yeah. Lucy's going to get a John memorial put in there, which was just such a out of left field thing that she just introduced in this chapter that I fucking loved. It was great. And yeah, that also obviously the Kenneteers and the Kennet elders get the go ahead to do things like the markets, make the lost Kennet. So it seems like a pretty good deal, but you never fucking know with these people. So it's great. It's very much a like, okay, this seems good, but I think it's Lucy or Verona who basically immediately opened the dream where we're going to get too soon with like, okay, we need to make sure we're good to fuck these guys up if they try to turn on us. So yeah, it's such a tentative truce. It might be the most bullshit truce that we've seen in this entire story, which is really saying something because we've seen some bullshit. I love the vibe of this whole negotiation as well. We mentioned like Matthew and Edith. There's this real back and forth between intensely personal disagreements and then much larger scale philosophical disagreements. And I love how this argument is constantly swinging back and forth between the two. It really captures the vibe of these two groups that are so close and yet so far and have really hurt each other, or one side much more than the other. It's just such a fun dynamic following through with this. And that's pretty much it. We get a lot of references to Charles's plan. I'm so interested to learn more about that. It like, you know, we're constantly getting told he sort of has a vision for where this is going, and I still just can't quite put that together myself. Like, you know, he seems to want to weaken the word of the practice or something, but like, what does that amount to? How does this achieve anything? Is still a blank for me, so I'm keen to learn more about that and see it. It shouldn't take too long from the looks of it, so that's nice. And as the negotiations close, the first thing Lucy does is check with Miss and basically, you know, validate her feelings about that being aggravating as hell. Just, you know, a great Lucy moment. She's continuing to grow. Like, this is, you know, Rook has pointed out to her that Miss has feelings and Miss is a person. And, you know, now we've got Lucy immediately kind of acting on that. Like, this is just the Lucy we know and love. She may not get some of that compassionate stuff naturally, but she listens and she learns. It's great. I guess we leave the end of the negotiations with Verona thinking about how she's got 23 hours of gainsaying left. And this really comes to hit her in the face when we figure out all her connection blockers were weakened by the lack of gainsaying. And her dad has found her magic stuff, and now her dad's going to be in on that. No, never mind. Walbo's just being a dick, and it's another fucking one of these dreams. It's just... we're into like, fool me five times, shame on you territory here, I think, with these dreams. It's great shit. But yeah, so we quickly set up tomorrow's dream, which we'll come back to later. But then we cut to the real shit, which is Mallory and Verona just kind of, you know, exchanging art tips, hanging out. I'm really glad these two are continuing to hang out together. Mallory is great, and this great kind of stand-in for Verona's balance with the Undercity in terms of the people of the Undercity, not just like her standing there. That more comes into Tashlet later. But what really jumped out to me is, like, Verona has this great rapport with Mallory. She's really great at kind of handling her, being fair, but, you know, not taking shit from her. And it reminded me of that segment with Declan when Verona was almost going to tutor Declan. Except somehow Mallory trying to force tattoos onto Verona in rage is less offensive than Declan's nonsense. But it's the same whole vibe of Verona is actually really good with people. She's a really good teacher when the situation is right. Like, she really enjoys sharing this information and this knowledge and her skills with people in the right circumstances. I guess it's like Alexander. That's Alexander-y side of her again. That was the good thing about Alexander. The thing that Alexander was genuinely a good person about was wanting, you know, the right people to work together. And Verona's kind of got that too. It's just like, I you know, this is what the Undercity can be good for her with. This is the part we weren't scared about when she was diving in there in Arc 14 is Verona has a lot of good to get out of this place. And you sort of see that with Mallory here. And I'm excited to see if that's going to continue forward. But yeah, anyway, Tashlet shows up kind of ruining the party, and her and Verona head off to, God, I've forgotten where they're going. But anyway, it's about the journey, not the destination, because Verona takes this opportunity to ask for a bit of an update on the familiar ritual. And yeah, Tashlet gives her the soft no that I think we all knew was coming. And like, honestly, like, please comment in the Reddit post if you disagree with me on this. I'd love to hear it. But like, we're on Tashlet's side here. Like, hit me up if you don't agree. I want to hear your side, but it just feels like such a sensible decision from Tashlet's end. Like, Avery and Snowdrop are this very special case, especially because Snowdrop is part of Avery. Outside of Snowdrop and Avery, it's kind of crazy to enter into a lifetime bond this quickly and at this age. Like, Tashlet is an especially interesting person to have this lens of it's too early for you, because I think when she was like 14-ish, like Verona's age, she more or less passed as human. She's kind of gone through this puberty of turning into a monster. And, you know, Verona is sort of in the early stages of puberty, I think. So it's like, Tashlet is this sort of 17-year-old who's in, you know, the most supernaturally exaggerated position to be like, you should not be committing to lifelong shit where you are right now. Like, you know, your life will be so different in 4 years. You will be so different. Don't sign up for this shit now. And like, I just love that Tashlet is the sort of person saying this to Verona, because it hits so much harder from her. Like, you know, her version of puberty turned her into an eye monster. She's a walking example. So yeah, a great metaphor for that stuff. And it's just a shame. Verona very much, I think, understands intellectually that yes, like, this is a fair and right decision, but it still obviously hurts her. So yeah, hopefully she gets through it. But, you know, I think overall pretty positive interaction. Just be a bit orkies for a bit. But yeah, as these Verona chapters have become wont to do, we then move on to the next of her sort of compartments of you know, life, where she talks Jeremy into, I'll say, reclaiming the house on Half Street for herself. And yeah, I don't know. Obviously, this is a bit more of a successful interaction. This isn't like the last time we did this sort of, you know, jump between all the aspects of Verona's life where they were all terrible. This Jeremy one, it seems to go pretty well. I mean, I've still obviously got mixed feelings on this, because as always with the Verona-Jeremy relationship, my concern is on the Jeremy end of things. We've seen from the Lucy chapters how he is romantically interested in Verona, and there's tension there because she doesn't really return that, and it's like, this is going to make that aspect of it worse, as much as this is a bit of a victory for Verona. Like, this is, you know, something I think that, you know, is good for her, and she's doing it in a good way, I guess. It's just, yeah, it's on the Jeremy end of things. As always, the concern with the Verona-Jeremy relationship is with Jeremy's feelings. So tentatively, this is a good thing. but we'll see. Anyway, luckily we skip over all of that. We jump into the dream meeting with everyone. And I mean, like, literally everyone who's kind of on the goody team here. Even Melissa and Louise have shown up. And Avery's here too. And, you know, in case you haven't heard, Avery's got a girlfriend now, which is just, I'm just going to quickly cover that. I love that as a moment to just very immediately establish. We haven't seen Avery tell Lucy and Verona that she has a girlfriend. And then rather than show us that moment, Walbo shows us the moment where Avery says it for what is clearly the 100th fucking time. And it's just that extra layer and that extra level of characterization Walbo always does, where you're immediately like, yeah, of course Avery, in like a very adorable way, has just been carrying on about this nonstop. Like, of course she has, and of course they love it, but like, Verona leans into it by feigning ignorance. Like, it's such a fun dynamic. It's a cute. Well, yeah, I'm so happy for Avery. but yeah. So anyway, they've got everyone here. We kind of catch Melissa and Louise up a bit. It does seem like we've all but given up on, you know, them not becoming just full on aware. I think Melissa is starting to be like just full on incorporated as a blackguard, which is very fun. But yeah, so we end the chapter with Verona sort of outlining the plan. They're going to make this lost version of Kennet by bringing in a near-miss comet. And I think the thing that really jumped out to me from this section is Verona points out they're going to have two, ideally three, domains set up when they're doing this to help link these three aspects of Kennet. And I mean, so assuming that the two, ideally three, domains is also Lucy and ideally Avery, on top of Verona being getting hers, where are Avery and Lucy planning on making their domains? Like, it could be a kind of 3-for-1 deal in the House of Half Straight. Are they going to do a triple combo like Taj Mahuchi situation? Or like, Avery could have one of those ones that's a bit more in the paths, like kind of more in Lost Kennet. I'm thinking, like, we've seen how domains can be shortcuts. It'd be great. Just from a story perspective, it'll be great if Avery has a door she can quickly walk through to come to Kennet and vice versa. We can really connect to these very separate parts of the story. I mean, something that is still happening is the Kenneteers are now alone in their banners, and really we can't have them start to properly be in each other's stories and banners again until there's a quick way between Thunder Bay and Kennet, and this would knock that out. But yeah, like with someone like Lucy, I don't see where she could get a domain that isn't the house on Half Street unless... like maybe her house, but there's been talk of like, you know, because that's her mum's, that you know, that's not easy. So yeah, if they're doing some Taj Mahuchi thing on the house on Half Street, I'm interested to see how the negotiations for that go. Yeah, I mean, I can't wait to see this. I'm kind of assuming at this point that the domain rituals tied into bringing Lost Kennet to fruition will kind of be the rest of this arc. But you never know with Wabo. Anyway, I guess we'll see. Super exciting. But yeah, that's pretty much these chapters. Yeah, Ruben will be back next week. Thank God. I apologize to all of you for having to listen to me ramble like this for what looks like it's going to be about 40 minutes. Hopefully it wasn't too terrible. But yeah, there'll be a Reddit thread where you can, you know, answer any of the questions I vaguely remember asking in this, or, you know, dispute anything I said. I'm really interested to hear more theories on what the deal with Pisces was. I haven't quite put mine together yet, but you know, the more ideas we can get in the community, the closer we'll get to figuring this out. Yeah, and I'll have the link to Snowdrop Tiny Fans document in there, which is very handy. But yeah, so yeah, Ruben will be back next week. Discussion questions will be back next week. Power Predictor hasn't gone anywhere. You can still launch your predictions in there. We've been getting some great ones. We're going to have a great backlog when we're back next week to start picking from. Yeah, so, you know, check out our Twitter as well. There's some exciting memes coming out there in a bit. Ruben keeps editing these docs to make me spell that out for you. We've also got a website, toofmedia.com. That's where you can hear from, you know, Jenny and Malia on Pact. They're hitting a extremely exciting part of the story right now. So go catch up if you're behind in that show. And don't forget to hit up our Patreon, patreon.com/doofmedia. I mean, that that Patreon not only funds everything to do with this show, like my, you know, microphone that I've, you know, managed to just set up in this new house, is, you know, was bought thanks to the Patreon funds. It's also all of the prizes we're going to have in our live stream. We're doing a shitload of giveaways in this 25-hour live stream. All of those are being funded entirely by that Patreon as well. So, you know, that's the sort of stuff. It all comes back to you guys in a way. And don't forget Wildbo's Patreon, patreon.com/Wildbo, because that all comes to us in the form of shit like 100 years lost. Like, you know, give Wildbo some money. He's earned it. He, you know, took Hazel on a nice 100-year journey. And so, yeah, I guess with that, I'll see you all next week for a regular episode.